Welcome to Grub and Grace. As we learned in the first episode, the history of Easter as we know it today is a bit more complicated and nuanced than what we learned in church. If you haven't listened to it, I encourage you to give that a listen first. Today we will be talking about the life and death and resurrection of Jesus and how his dream of justice applies to the world today. For the earliest believers, Jesus represented a dream. A dream which seems so unreasonable and so impractical that few, even now, fully believe it. Reverend Mark Feldmeyer put it this way. For 3 years, Jesus dreamed out loud that someday love would overcome hate, that goodness would triumph over evil, kindness would defeat cruelty, humbleness would overthrow pride, mercy would turn strangers into friends, and forgiveness would transform enemies into brothers. Until everything that was broken in the world would be brought back together and restored. That was the dream of Jesus. His earliest disciples believed it. Like you, they believed that there was a better world possible. So they left everything to follow that dreamer in pursuit of his dream. Because they believed that if they followed the dream and lived it out in their daily lives, they could actually change the world. That very first Easter morning, Jesus' disciples woke up much like you and I did today. We woke up to a world that is oppressed by empire and war-stricken lands. In our world today, we see death and destruction in places like Gaza and Ukraine, the exploitation of people and stripping the lands for profits in countries like the Congo, ecological disasters, economic disparities, racism, hunger, poverty, and disease. When we're really honest about what is going on in our world, sometimes it can be really hard to believe everything will be okay in the end. Every day, Jesus witnessed his own Jewish people, as well as other citizens, under Roman military occupation and suffered daily under injustice. Much like in our modern world, he saw how tense, tired, and desperate everyone had become. When we look at Jesus' dream, though, Easter is a catalyst for living a life of hope. Immanuel Kant wrote about the importance of hope and how closely it is aligned with our actions. Kant said, "The reason we do those things, the reason we commit to someone or some purpose is because we hope that it's going to end well. We can't rationally or logically prove hope. Instead, we can only go about our daily decisions and choices and actions, believing that there is some good end point, some outcome at the conclusion of it." He says that we have to have this hope, and that hope is what motivates our actions. That doesn't give us a free pass to just let things work themselves out on their own or to not get involved in solving the world's problems. Our mission is to help make things right in this moment, in our time. Melissa Neeb encapsulates this when she wrote, "Contrary to what we were taught, it is much easier to focus on eternity instead of doing the hard work of making things better, here and now, and bringing heaven down to earth as Jesus worked to do. We don't have to wait for God to make everything right in the end. We can cooperate with God's purposes right now to make things right, in this moment." Brian Recker recently wrote about Jesus' entry into Jerusalem in a piece titled, "The Time Jesus Staged a Protest March." He goes on by saying that Jesus' entry wasn't a spontaneous celebration, but rather a deliberate act of political activism, political theater of the highest order. A protest meant to arrest the attention of the empire and the systems of domination centered in Jerusalem. A triumphal entry was just the type of political spectacle that conquering kings or empires would stage after a great victory. Recker goes on to say that Jesus intentionally parodies the empire's pomp and is a brilliant subversion deliberate, disruptive, and drenched in meaning. It was an announcement that a new kingdom is coming, that the empire is a sham and on its way out. The people waving branches weren't performing a pious ritual. They were peasants crying out for material deliverance. They wanted Jesus to turn the world upside down. He quotes Drew Hart saying, "Each branch or cloak that was laid down before Jesus represented the desire to break free from captivity of the status quo." Now, Jesus must have made quite a stir as the Pharisees, according to Luke 19, pleaded with him to order down his disciples and followers, to which Jesus replied, "I tell you, if these were silent, the stones would shout out." This, of course, being a direct reference to Habakkuk 2:11 and a scathing critique of the oppressive nature of those above to the least of these below. And there is nothing new under the sun. It just takes a slightly different, adjacent approach in today's world. But not all who are under the weight of oppression are able to see it. Martin Luther King Jr. wrote in his book, Why We Can't Wait, "The white poor also suffer deprivation and humiliation of poverty, if not of color. They are chained by the weight of discrimination, though its badge of degradation does not mark them. It corrupts their lives, frustrates their opportunities, and withers their education. In one sense, it is more evil for them because it has confused so many by prejudice that they have supported their own oppressors." Until we are able to see Jesus' critique fully for what it is, justice for the poor, the marginalized, and the least of these may never coalesce. Biblical scholar Dan McClellan brings up a few points about the historical Jesus. He says that the reconstruction of the historical Jesus doesn't really have a role in the Sanhedrin, which is the Jewish legislation and judicial assembly, in Jesus' death. It was probably the Romans who marked Jesus after he drove a bunch of people out of the temple and started a small riot. Passover was the biggest festival celebration of the year in the giant capital city of Jerusalem, and the Romans were always struggling to keep the peace. If anything put Jesus on the Romans' radar, it was making a whip and driving a bunch of people out of the Jewish temple and starting a small riot. From a critical historical Jesus point of view, that was probably what got him killed. I could then go into how the absolution of a historical murderous Pilot to shifting the blame on a Jewish people is a literary creation for an anti-Semitic narrative, but that's not the point I'll be getting to. You can always read Bart Ehrman's book, Jesus Before the Gospels, which goes into choosing social memory to talk about how the presentation of Jesus' life and death in the Gospels could be serving certain interests within the social memory of what actually happened. As with what Dan said, though, Jesus concludes his triumphal demonstration with an act of civil disobedience. His fulfillment of scripture wasn't what everyone expected. He wasn't ushering in a new empire, but rather proclaiming the end of empire. He was not another war hawk for empire, but a nonviolent messiah with a dream for a better world. Jesus understood the assignment and what this would cost him. He told his disciples to take up their crosses to follow him. Taking after Jesus' example, Martin Luther King Jr. would often tell other leaders before their nonviolent protests to be prepared to endure violence. The cross wasn't a metaphor. The cross was a very real device used for state execution. Recker states that the paradox and demand of following Jesus is that the path towards liberation will usually be a path of suffering. When we join Jesus in disruptive protests against empire, the empire strikes back. If we choose this path of nonviolence, if we stand with the marginalized, if we confront and oppose systems of death, those death-dealing systems may come for us. Martin Luther King Jr. again wrote in his book, Why We Can't Wait, by saying, "In that dramatic scene on Calvary's Hill, three men were crucified. all three were crucified for the same crime, the crime of extremism. Two were extremists for immorality, and thus fell below their environment. The other, Jesus Christ, was an extremist for love, truth, and goodness, and thereby rose above his environment. Perhaps the South, the nation, and the whole world are in dire need of creative extremists. Easter was never intended to be about gathering all the facts so that we could prove the bodily resurrection of Jesus 2,000 years later. Easter is about how all of us, like Jesus, are moving from life to death to new life, becoming different and new in this life and in the next. Easter is a story for those who feel stuck, but still want to believe that the world really is headed in a direction of good, that it's not random or meaningless or aimless, and that the universe is bending toward goodness and justice, and that we get a chance to be a part of bending it in that way. On Easter, the only question that remains is, will we pursue the dream? That's it for today's episode of Grub and Grace. I really hope you enjoyed part one and part two of our Easter message. If you like the content that we produce, be sure to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you can listen, and pass these episodes off to a friend. And until next time, stay curious, keep an open mind, and celebrate the traditions that bring us all together.